This is the second year that Dr. John Marciano has led a popular study group considering Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Dr. Marciano is Emeritus Professor, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. In 2004, he began the series at the now-departed Midnight Special Bookstore in Santa Monica. The series now continues at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. Every month, this group meets to discuss the assigned reading, individual chapters in People's History. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. The following recording by the LA Sound Posse from May 24, 2005 contains John's commentary and discussions of Chapter 7 of People's History. The LA Sound Posse records and publishes anti-copyrighted talks and events such as this and can be reached at lasoundposse.org. The contact information will be repeated at the end of the recording.
Why don't we gather around and...
One of the best ways of opposing the war is to...
Come into the circle. Okay, while we're getting ready to begin, Fred brought in... This is the Voices of a People's History. This just came out with Howard Zinn and Anthony Arno that has essentially documents, speeches, letters that have appeared, excerpts that appeared in the People's History book itself. I'm just going to pass it around. He wanted to have people look at it. All right, and this is a dramatic reading celebrating the enduring spirit of dissent, edited by Howard Zinn. The People Speak. It's a small version of the larger book that's going around. It includes Columbus and Indian removal, Frederick Douglass, John Brown, Mark Twain, Helen Keller, Fannie Lou Hamer, Malcolm X, Vietnam, etc. Okay. These are to be shared. I talked to Sally and Peter when they had an event in the sanctuary of the church a few weeks ago. We started talking about this photograph from the film Arlington West, which was on the cover of the Syracuse Cultural Workers brochure, which is absolutely marvelous group in upstate New York that came out of the Syracuse Peace Council, which is the oldest urban peace council still going in the United States. It began in 1936. And I know some of the founders, and I talked to Peter and Sally, and I said, oh, did you see the Syracuse Cultural Workers brochure? And they pulled it out of their box, and they said, oh, yeah, we were talking to Dick Cool today. Oh, well, I know Dick. So I ordered about 30 of these, and I've sent them around the country to friends, many of whom are teachers. And I got a couple for this group. So during the break or whatever, whoever wants to take one first, get a list and share it, get it around one way or another. And that's the whole idea. And for those of you who've seen it, you know, it's an incredibly powerful and moving documentary. And of course, most of it's filmed here. We're in Venice, over there in Santa Monica on the beach. Just get it around to people. I got them to get rid of them. Just make sure eventually everybody in this group gets to see it. These are the essays that I handed around the first group by Noam Chomsky, a short essay on Howard Zinn. So nice when you hand out things, unlike when I taught college classes. Somebody say, is it going to be on the test, Dr. Marciano? No. If you haven't had a chance to look at it, check the syllabus, and if not, get back to me and I'll give you the site. It's from an article, it's by Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. It's an article in the Monthly Review last summer, I believe.
You mailed it to us?
Yes, I did. I love going to the post office. I've been mailing these things around the country. I've been burning CD copies, about 100. I go to Staples. I've been to Staples almost every day. I go buy discs, and then I CD things, and then I bought a little duper, one-to-one duper, and then I make copies, and I just mail them. And, you know, post office, people are nice to you. You actually get things done. Nobody hassles you. It's concrete, you know. You don't have to worry about what's happening. Oh, one other thing I sent around. Some of you may not have checked your email today, but it was on Tom's Dispatch. Tom Engelhart, who is with the Nation Institute, shared Howard Zinn's commencement address at Spelman College in Atlanta, which was May 15th. Zinn was fired there 40 years ago and he just got a degree. I sent Howard a note. I said, wow, it took you a long time to get that honorary doctorate. So it's a very wonderful, powerful, short statement. And so also I will make copies for those of you who don't have email. You know, it's one of those few commencement addresses. You remember your own commencement address, I'm sure. But it's one of the few commencement addresses that actually says something very, very good. And he quotes from Langston Hughes, quotes from Marion Wright Edelman, who's the director of the Children's Defense Fund, who was one of his students at Spelman. He also quotes from Alice Walker, who also was a student of his at Spelman, who wrote on the back of his book that he was the best teacher she ever had. Wow, now that's a plug for your book, let me tell you. Okay, let's talk about Chapter 7, As Long as Grass Grows or Water Runs. I thought we'd start with a quote from former president, the late president, late a long time ago, evidently, Teddy Roosevelt, that would establish the fundamental premise that really undergirds the European and Euro-American views toward the original Americans. And I quote, "It is indeed a warped, perverse, and silly morality which would forbid a course of conquest that has turned whole continents into the seats of mighty and flourishing civilizations. All men of sane and wholesome thought soon dismiss with impatient contempt the plea that these continents should be reversed." It's not reversed. Reserved is the word, excuse me, yes. Not reversed. We're going to reserve this. "For the use of scattered savage tribes whose life was but a few degrees less meaningless, squalid, and ferocious than that of the wild beasts with whom they hold joint ownership." End of quote. What a guy. Evidently, those of us who have a total and profound disagreement with Teddy Roosevelt's racist views must be insane.
What year?
I don't have the year. Probably late 1890s, maybe early 1900s. Let's see, became president when, I forget the name of the gentleman who killed McKinley, wounded McKinley at the Pan Am Exposition in Buffalo, New York. I used to take my kids, no, not to see the site. We used to go sledding there. It's in Delaware Park in Buffalo, and it's right across the, right across the grassy knoll. Now, with that as sort of foundation, Zinn points out, of course, that when we went through schools and also comments that we heard in the media, but especially with our schooling, that the polite term Indian removal was used, which essentially meant, when we decode it, aggression and clearing the land for white settlers. And of course, when we talked about in the chapter last time in Columbus, that the white settlers came here to essentially an empty continent. There was no one here. They evidently didn't see the anywhere from 7 to 17 million original Americans who were wandering around in what is now North America. I want to tie together Zinn's comments with the fundamental premises underlying the policies toward original Americans that was put forth in Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's article. And I commend that article to you. If you haven't looked at it yet, please do. It's called The Grid of History, Cowboys and Indians. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, who's at Cal State Hayward, I believe, in the history department, who's actually coming out with a new book on the Contras and is going to be in the LA area in September at Skylight Books, reading from her book. She argues that the United States, a formal political entity called the United States, became an expansionist and imperialist power in 1776. It has been since, and military conquest is and has been at the heart of this empire. That is, it is as American as apple pie, motherhood, and used to be Chevrolet. And that those of us who are critical of the present war in Iraq and other single U.S. actions, and we could list them, I mean, just throw a dart on the globe, Panama, Grenada, or start in this hemisphere. She's saying that those who see single actions as aberrations, that is, an exception to an otherwise noble and benevolent foreign policy, are simply wrong. And that we can only do this by erasing history, the history which is at the heart of any anti-imperialist critiques that need to be made of our present foreign policy. Her argument is to see what's happening in Iraq can only be done as somehow as if it's an accident to an otherwise 230-year history means that we hide the continuity and a small departure is exaggerated. She also argues that white supremacy is absolutely essential to understanding the genocidal assault on first Americans by Europeans, and that this ideology of white supremacy can be traced to two things: the colonizing ventures of the Christian Crusades into Muslim areas, and most importantly for U.S. history, the Calvinist Protestant colonization of Ireland. That these were the models for the colonization of the Western Hemisphere and the assaults against indigenous Americans or American Indians. I want to examine briefly one aspect of her critique and then tie it into Zinn's discussion of American Indians. That is the defining power and views of Puritanism and Calvinist Protestantism that uniquely define white supremacy as a political and religious ideology. They were the chosen people who had a covenant with God that essentially meant ethnic cleansing of the nation by removing the Indian savages. The Ulster Scots Calvinists who ended up here first were the settlers and colonizers of Northern Ireland. Their origin story, many of them ending up settling in what is now the Allegheny, Appalachian areas of the United States, their origin story becomes the official U.S. origin story. They are the pilgrims or the settlers doing God's will and forging the promised land while being surrounded by savages and, of course, shedding their blood, which is a sanctifying act, first against the Irish in Ulster and then Native Americans here. She argues also that the ideology of white supremacy has also served as a political diversion and release valve for those in power in the United States, as it neutralized and undermined class antagonisms of the landless and poor whites against the landed and rich, and in which we have a distribution of confiscated lands and properties of the Irish in Ireland and of American Indians and then blacks in the United States. She argues further that the English and colonist policy of exterminating Indians here was foreshadowed by the English assault and violence in Northern Ireland, where the ancient Irish social system was attacked, whole clans slaughtered, and the remainder brutalized. That is, the search and destroy process that the English used in Ireland was then brought to the United States, and of course later in the Philippines and in Vietnam, that similar process was used against the Filipinos and the Vietnamese. The Calvinist Protestant settlers here were told that they were doing God's will for salvation here, as well as in Ireland, for salvation and, of course, title to Irish lands. Salvation alone wouldn't be enough. The native Irish Catholics, of course, were clearly not destined for salvation, and this process was repeated in the Americas against Indians. Therefore, the founding of the United States as a political state. And when you go back and read very, very carefully the words of the founders, when you read Jefferson and you read George Washington and you read Benjamin Franklin, every time I go down Montana and see the little quotes there from Ben Franklin on that school, I'm reminded of some of the attitudes that Franklin had. He was kind of ambivalent, but he had very, very racist attitudes about Indians, even though he recognized that especially those in the Iroquois Confederacy were instrumental in teaching the colonists about democracy. So the founding of the U.S. as a political state is tied to this settler mentality, and Dunbar Ortiz argues that we did not just found a propertied, slave-owning, white male republic, but also a settler, colonialist, and imperialist aggressor state. And one of the preeminent figures in that origin story, in that history, if you got a $20 bill, you can pull it out, is our friend Andrew Jackson, who coined the phrase extending the area of freedom, which she argues essentially meant extending slavery into Texas in violation of Mexican laws, quickly followed by a slaveholder's rebellion and recognition by the United States in annexation. The term freedom was a code term for the continental and worldwide expansion of the world's leading slave power. And we often forget that at that point. The United States was the leading slave power in the world at that time. White supremacy was therefore the working ideology for the English theft of Indian lands and especially for the justification of slavery. And this ideology is tied closely to our origin myth, which itself, when you look at the history, it's closely tied to the parallel Afrikaner myth in South Africa, in terms of white settlers going into a savage area, bringing Christianity with them. This white supremacy ideology formed the core of U.S. foreign relations from the founding of the nation to the present, and American supremacy and imperialism are inseparable from this origin story and from the definition of patriotism. Therefore, white supremacy and imperialism are the lifeblood of the U.S. state, an argument that is even hard to take for radicals who consider themselves anti-imperialists and who oppose some aspects of U.S. foreign policy. I would argue that in her work and Zinn, that they complement each other in developing a thesis that the U.S. was and remains essentially imperialist and racist, and this is not a divergence from a well-intentioned past, which is what essentially we learned in schools. That is, that we have and are always doing good when we go abroad. We're just absolutely so zealous at doing good that sometimes we make mistakes. Because we're just trying to spread, like Johnny Appleseed, trying to spread democracy and freedom around the world. She categorically rejects that perspective. She asserts that U.S. citizens like to pretend that we have no imperial and expansionist past, yet this began with our colonial days, often at the expense of Indians and Mexicans, and has been a marked feature of U.S. history that has continued with the imperial conquest of Hawaii as well. I mean, it's interesting if you read the history of how the United States ended up with Hawaii. It's fascinating. I forget when Hawaii became a state, but who had any idea what the history was? So the conflict that founded this country, which was a violent conflict, it was a war of independence. Sometimes it's been called a war of national liberation. She would argue essentially was a war for expansion. So understanding the real nature of U.S. expansion is absolutely critical to the context that Zinn develops in this chapter. That is, to understand the actual historical record as opposed to the fairy tale school textbook version that we got. That is, if we were to understand his arguments about American Indians and the centuries long, one could go back, it depends. You could go back to the war between colonists in the Pequots in what is now Connecticut in 1607, and if you end that long, long history of wars, let's say with the Wounded Knee in 1890, you're talking almost 300 years. So wars, many wars by Europeans and Euro-Americans. Zinn also discusses, of course, it goes back to Andrew Jackson, in many ways sort of the archetypal figure, Indian killer, slave trader, speculator, merchant, and then president in the context of a series of treaties with Indians of the Southwest, all of which were broken, by the way. I've looked at a number of scholarly sites and argue that every single treaty signed by the United States with American Indian nations has been broken. And, of course, the United States can only sign treaties with sovereign nations. You know, the U.S. can't sign a treaty with Hoboken, New Jersey. So every single treaty has been broken. And many of those treaties that were broken, of course, in white Europeans and Euro-Americans getting land, including Jackson, they benefited from land being taken from the Indians. And of course, this history includes the Seminole War in what is now Florida, which until the Vietnam War was the longest war in U.S. history in terms of the number of years. And yet, you know, every time now and then when you turn on ESPN and you know, I watch the sports news and they show Florida State University, the Seminoles, there's still a guy riding around on a horse with, you know, big feathers, etc., and they're doing that tomahawk thing, which the Atlanta Braves fans do also, which is why every time the Atlanta Braves is in a playoff of the World Series, I root for the other team. I don't care who they're playing. So the war with the Seminole led up to what we learned was called, remember, the Florida Purchase of 1819. We sort of purchased Florida, okay? What did we learn about Jackson in our school texts and classrooms? I was just telling Sammy what I learned in my American history class at the University of Rochester as we read Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s The Age of Jackson. Schlesinger was a big Kennedy advisor and admirer, and my professor, Richard Wade, was a big history honcho of that time and also was a big Kennedy fan. I mean, we learned about Jackson, the Democrat, the soldier, the frontiersman, the man of the people. We did not learn about Jackson, the slave owner, the land speculator, and the mad dog killer of Indians, and he was a mad dog killer, let's not mince any words. So we have to ask ourselves, when it comes to what we've learned, is how we can become critically literate about the history of the country in which we now live and the issues that affect us and the historical past without having the whole record in front of us. And we need to question the role of educators, and I extend that to the media and the clergy, in passing on uncritically the views of dominant elites and others and keeping us blind and not giving us critical tools, so therefore we're unable to challenge the dominant views, which means then when we teach, we reproduce what's been given to us, which means you're forced to teach some of the depressing reality of U.S. history, which is why when I use Zinn's book, my students would always get depressed, very depressed. It's negative. It's a negative book. Yeah, it is negative at times, okay? But it's also a book of resistance. It's very negative when a group of people come in, take people's land, slaughter them, force them to march on the Trail of Tears, thousands die, they starve. Extremely negative, very depressing. Zinn shares an important quote from Secretary of War Lewis Cass on human nature, progressive improvement, and the fundamental difference between whites and savages. Now, all of these differences are based on fundamental philosophic assumptions about human nature and people. By progressive development, Cass and others at that time, of course, meant the rule of private property and capitalism as opposed to the sustainable economy and what we might call primitive communism of Indians, in which land was held in common. All right. If people faced droughts and terrible conditions, people suffered as a people. If there were wonderful conditions, they gained as a people. There was no question of the elders or the leaders in those nations living in incredible mansions while other people starved. Cass's comment reflects the fact that our fundamental premises about human nature are the foundation of all views on Indians and U.S. policies. We build our social, economic, and political views upon the base of what it means to be human. Zinn comments on Cass's quite marvelous ignorance of Indian life that the original Americans, quote, a barbarous people depending for subsistence upon the chase, cannot live in contact with a civilized community. Given what we usually define as civilized, we must ask, who truly were the civilized, Euro-Americans or Indians? As we discussed last month, and I will repeat this, for a long time Native Americans have been rebuking textbook authors and others who have reserved the adjective civilized for Europeans. They have criticized this view as unjust, quote, unjust to the life of our people. What is civilization? Its marks are a noble religion and philosophy, original art, stirring music, rich story and legend. We had these. Then we were not savages, but a civilized race. And we should also add the clear governance structures with far more equality and reciprocity than were found in the Euro-American government structures, including the United States, where, for example, women did not gain full formal political equality till 1920, and repressed racial minorities did not gain full access to the vote until the mid-1960s. That kind of equality existed in Native American nations centuries ago. In his book, another book that I used in the years past in my classes, Lies My Teacher Told Me, by sociologist James Lowen, Lowen asserts that historically American Indians have been the most lied about subset of our population. That's why in learning about Native Americans, quote, one does not start from point zero, but from minus 10. Study of the history of Indian people and relations with European invaders cannot be a happy one. Loewen argues that if we are to look Indian history squarely in the eye, we are going to get red eyes. We are going to weep and become enraged. This is our past, and we must acknowledge it. And the problem is that the picture, even now, though the textbooks have been improved, the picture of the primitive savage enmeshed in wars with nature and other humans often drives the textbooks, and especially the textbooks for those of us who are older, that imposes a particular view on the ancient past. So in the encounter, when we started with the encounter with Columbus, we have to ask some fundamental questions. In the encounter between Europeans and savages in the Americas that began in 1492, who truly terrorized whom? Who enslaved whom? Who destroyed lands and cultures? And what have we learned about these horrors in our schools and media? As I mentioned before, a basic and fundamental fact is that each and every treaty signed formally by the United States government with Indian nations was broken by the U.S. It takes a monumental level of arrogance and hypocrisy for our political leaders to condemn such actions by other governments now, or of course, as we used to hear all the time during the Cold War, that you couldn't trust the Soviet Union or China or Vietnam or anybody else because they're always breaking treaties. When in fact, breaking treaties has been also been as American as apple pie since 1776. Zinn discusses the various and sordid means whites used to rob Indians of their lands, from outright violence to alcohol to fraud. And on page 135, he quotes from Dale Van Evry's book, The Disinherited. And I'll just quote some of this. Van Evry says, "In the long record of man's inhumanity, exile has wrung moans of anguish from many different peoples. Upon no people could it ever have fallen with a more shattering impact than upon the Eastern Indians," and you could extend that as well. "The Indian was particularly susceptible to every sensory attribute of every natural feature of his surroundings." His and her, you'd have to change the gender. "He lived in the open. He knew every marsh, glade, hilltop, rock, spring, creek, as only the hunter can know them. He had never fully grasped the principle establishing private ownership as any more rational than private ownership of the air, but he loved the land with a deeper emotion than could any proprietor. He felt himself as much a part of it as the rocks and trees, the animals and birds. His homeland was holy ground, sanctified for him as the resting place of the bones of his ancestors and the natural shrine of his religion. He conceived its waterfalls and ridges, its clouds and mists, its glens and meadows, to be inhabited by the myriad of spirits with whom he held daily communion." So here you have, in a sense, it reveals the full impact of what had happened in what is now the United States, that those with a sacred connection to nature and spirit were destroyed by those who claim to have a connection to spiritual values, but essentially were chained to private property, profit, and power. And in order to pursue those ends, had to destroy these other cultures. You can also look on page 137, in which a Moravian minister is quoted by Van Evry about how Indian life was governed, and ask ourselves, when we think about that, in terms of the fairly egalitarian, and this is without romanticizing some of the serious violence that existed between various Indian nations, but I'm talking internally now. When we ask about how Indian life was governed, we perhaps should ask ourselves again, who have been the civilized ones, the ones truly connected to the great circle of life and land? These profound differences are also found in Zinn's discussion regarding the Indian Removal Bill, which actually had a real debate and a narrow passage in the United States. It's amazing to think that there at least was enough of a debate about what happened. And also in the debate and discussion about the laws passed by the state, what is now the state of Georgia, to take Cherokee land. And we need to reflect deeply as well, and here I'm quoting on page 140, about the Golden Rule by the Cherokee. "We entreat those to whom the foregoing paragraphs are addressed." This was a plea to the United States that people did not want to be removed from their ancient lands. as they were, and of course, forced on the Trail of Tears through bitter weather where thousands died. It says, we entreat those to whom the foregoing paragraphs are addressed to remember the great law of love, do to others as ye would that others should do to you. We pray them to remember that, for the sake of principle, their forefathers were compelled to leave, therefore driven from the old world, and that the winds of persecution wafted them over the great waters and landed them on the shores of the new world, when the Indian was the sole lord and proprietor of these extensive domains. Let them remember in what way they were received by the savage of America when power was in his hand and his ferocity could not be restrained by any human arm. Ward Churchill, scholar, argues that in the initial contact in what is now the United States, he has been unable to find a single incident in which Native Americans or American Indians visited violence on Europeans. The Europeans always initiated that violence. And then, of course, you're on your own land and people responded in kind. So when we think about the golden rule, we think of the connection of people with the land and the incredible tragedy that unfolded, let's say if you begin in 1607, began before that, certainly in the Southwest, but here in the East, and you think about the nature of the golden rule that we learned in schools and from our parents, that is what I would call the human golden rule, as opposed to what I would argue the golden rule that runs this country, which is he who has the gold makes the rules. That's the real rule that dominates. We see what a tragedy unfolded and how this golden rule was savaged by Jackson and others in this period. So we have a history in which treaties were broken, in which there was relentless expansion and violence from what is now Cape Cod. You can walk around on Cape Cod and to some Indian burial grounds that still exist, or on Martha's Vineyard. So from the, almost the furthest eastern outpost of the United States, all the way, of course, as we discussed last time, all the way here into California, in one long, unbroken, relentless effort to break treaties and to engage in violence. Yet there seems to be, at this point in our history, little shame among the general population and virtually none among elected officials about what the historical record shows us clearly are crimes. They are documented. This is not Howard Zinn developing some interpretation. The debate is in the interpretation. We have the history just the way we have the history about Columbus. I'm going to finish up with just a couple of comments on the Trail of Tears and the loss of life for the Cherokee as they were marched across from what is now the Southeast to Indian territory, which was set aside for Native Americans or Indians, which then became Oklahoma, which then was overrun when they opened those lands up and whites came in and pushed Indians out. Regarding the Trail of Tears, I come back to an issue that I raised last time from the scholarship of historian David Stannard on the moral ranking of victims. We learn, as we should, of the untold thousands, hundreds of thousands, who knows how many, numbers of Jews who lost their lives in forced marches near the end of World War II. Many of us growing up learned about the infamous Bataan March in World War II of U.S. prisoners of war by the Japanese. We identify with them as any reasonable person on this earth would. But we have learned precious little about the Trail of Tears and those victims. Once again, I would argue, proving Stannard's thesis that it is the nature of the victim and the victimizer that shapes the educational and moral lessons that we learn, not the crime itself. It is highly selective. It depends on who you're bombing, who you're burning, who's got power, who doesn't. It's not that we have a principled objection to violence, all right? And as far as I know, in terms of certainly U.S. presidents and the Congresses, since we became a formal nation and Washington became president in 1789, I don't know of any American president who's been a pacifist. So it's not the crime itself. It's the victim and the victimizer. Even though, arguably, in this country, the crime against original Americans is our great Holocaust, our great sin. But it has been denied and ignored and distorted so much that history and memory are not allowed to shape the present. And that's one of the powerful aspects, I think, of his work, is that we're forced to deal with this in the present, but have to have memory about the past in order to confront what is happening in this society today to the descendants of those who lost their land centuries ago, given the unemployment rates among American Indians and all sorts of other social aspects that are clearly the worst in the country. It's not as if these issues disappeared and now everything's fine. So let's take a break and then let's open it up.
Comment.
Yeah, let's open it up.
When Cortez went to Mexico fighting the Aztecs, all of the surrounding tribes allied themselves with Cortez because of how cruel the Aztecs had been of decimating and conquering all the neighboring tribes. So there was significant Indian upon Indian violence.
Yeah.
If you and I go to South Central LA today, the statistics on black violence are at all-time highs, and have been since the 1950s, for that matter, in urban city centers. When we talk about the American Indians, the Indian-on-Indian violence between the Cherokees, the Apaches, the Iroquois, against the Mohawks, the Seminoles against their neighboring, there was decades of violence of Indian-upon-Indian. Is it being said that there's any difference in the human condition, that it's just, quote-unquote, natural to be violent in these, what was Hitler's word, Lebensraum, this thing about more land? You know, the phrase he used, we want more space, was his reasoning for putting violence on all of his neighbors. Is this a function of the human condition, or can you really lay it at the feet of the Euro-Americans in their expansionist attitudes towards wiping out the American Indians?
The argument being made by Dunbar Ortiz, by Ward Churchill, by Zinn, is really the argument in terms of the clash between Europeans and Euro-Americans and indigenous peoples who were here, granting that there was various levels of violence between Indian nations who were here, not just in what is now the United States, but as you said, you go down through Mexico, Central America, and into South America, so that we can't romanticize what existed, though we do know from Columbus's logs and we do know from other history that there were internal to groups. There were groups that had such egalitarian and almost pacific relations that the violence that we see internal to the United States or internal to communities did not exist. Child abuse, other kinds of things. I don't know enough about the, and again, from reading this and rereading it, I have to study more in terms of the unfolding of the history. For example, the unfolding of the violence in the eastern United States between some of the tribes in the Iroquois Confederacy and the Mohawks, for example. And that, as I recall from my reading of The Last Mohicans, the tensions between some of those nations and the Mohawks. So, but this is an issue we talked about last time, and it's an issue that we're going to revisit, that is, what in human history explains the nature of violence within the human species. Yeah.
Actually, that's exactly, I was going to ask something about that, but I'll segue it into another question or statement.
Or you can ask about that as well.
I was going to say part of it is patriarchy, and also is there something unique in the white male's condition that makes him so barbaric to other dark-skinned cultures? And then I totally appreciate that the point he made, which is Indians had a history of violence with each other, as do probably almost every nation or culture had some sort of violence somewhere. But we see it happening right now. Iraq is sort of another holocaust of dark-skinned indigenous people, Palestinians. Just seems like it's a cycle that repeats itself most often on dark-skinned people. You very rarely see it on, well, I guess there was Bosnia and that, but it just...
Well,
yeah.
That's her argument, and as well as other scholars, about the nature of racism over the last five centuries. But let's recall, I mean, you mentioned the Irish. White as can be white, though the Irish were considered a race, a barbaric race by the English, before white Europeans marauded Central America and South America and Asia and Africa. They marauded against the Irish and Eastern Europe and enslaved people. That's where we get the term, the Slavs. Okay, that's where the word comes from. So the original imperialism and expansion was about white people against white people. So we have to be careful here. I mean, there's nothing, because I reject, I mean, I guess I'm going to have to go back and reread some of the anthropology and read some of Jared Diamond's work. But there's a growing movement in the country, the way they're always looking for a gene to explain things. So now they're looking for a violence gene. And I start with the notion that human nature is as humans have done, which means we have the potential to be poetic, magnificent, gentle, loving, and at the same time, humans have done the most barbaric, incredible, chilling things. And it's crossed cultures, there's no doubt about that. As to whether we're hardwired, I have a real question about that, because if the human species were hardwired, then it'd be hard to explain what Columbus said about the Taino being so gentle and wonderful toward these invaders.
Well, that sort of goes on to the first thing I said, which doesn't really get talked about very much, which is patriarchy. And I think if there were more women, if you had more of a maternal energy balancing things out, if you look at any sort of male-dominated institution, the military, sports teams, you know, a lot of governments, it's a lot of aggression. And not to say that women don't have aggression, but I think that it's less likely to be physical violence. And if there was some more of a balance with that just across cultures, I think that Native Americans did have a lot of matriarchal principles in their cultures, and something that we don't, you know, Europeans and most cultures now, it seems to be not virtually non-existent. So I think, again, patriarchy is a big issue in this whole thing.
I absolutely agree with you. If you go back and you look at, in fact, you go back to read some of the works of feminist historians like Gerda Lerner. You go back to Susan Brownmiller's work on rape. You read Sheila Robotham. You read Juliette Mitchell's book, Women, the Longest Revolution, that the nature of patriarchy, male violence, which crosses all cultures, all times, is absolutely essential to this issue. Women are not immune from violence, depending on the nature of the culture. For example, the violence in this society, I would argue that we're really the extreme in terms of alienation and violence, where you get to the point where, because of such alienation and what's been done to them, you have women actually abusing and killing their own children. Unheard of, at least as far as I've been able to find out, in Native American nations, unless people face dire starvation. So it happens, but overwhelmingly in sports, in media, you're talking about male power and male violence against women, which is off the charts compared to other crimes, which are called hate crimes. Violence against women in this society is not a national hate crime. I totally agree with you.
I bought Barbara Ehrenreich's book that she wrote specifically to check this question out about women in war. And she challenges the notion that women and men are that different, as far as I can go, because I haven't read it. I just know in cultures where women are very violent, and this new study of women with bullies and stuff, there's evidence even in primates that because of class structure and hierarchy, that mother primates actually kill their babies so that the leader won't steal them. So we've simplified with right, wrong, flip, you know, patriarchy versus matriarchy. We have to, I think, be careful, because I think that it's more complex.
Yeah, I haven't read, I mean, I've read a number of her books, and really think Barbara Ehrenreich is one of the very perceptive people in this country. That particular book I haven't read.
Going back a little bit to the tribal situations in this continent, the Nahua, which was termed Aztec, their empire stretched all the way up to Michigan. Michigan is actually is derived from a Nahuan word. They had an empire that they expanded all the way from Mexico City up to Michigan, all through Central America. They were extremely violent, class-oriented society, that there was a and they were also at the same time probably the most what we would see as developed society. They pulled back after because of certain climate conditions and things of that nature. But the mound builders, if you see a recreation of their cities, it looks just like an Aztec city, a Nahuan city. I think from when I was working at the store, there was a guy that was very versed in the history of original Aboriginal peoples in this continent, including the Nahua. I think if you looked at a lot of the tribal peoples, even their concepts of war were not like where they were wiping everybody out. They were not as aggressive. There was things where they would do to shame the other people, the people they were fighting with, and things of that nature. It wasn't that it didn't exist, but it wasn't as aggressive as what the Europeans brought to this continent. And it goes back to the things where like the more quote-unquote primitive societies, the more hunter-gatherer societies are extremely peaceful people. To when they became more and more developed, more and more attached to the land, more and more that way, they would also become much more aggressive in nature. And if you go back far enough in the European history, that when more and more people got attached to the land, to agriculture, herding, things of that nature, they became the more aggressive types of people, like the Mongols were herding peoples, and they became a very aggressive force that basically almost conquered Europe, even. It has to do with, I think, if you look at anthropological studies, the more connected they got to the concept of ownership, the more aggressive they became, this various societies became.
When you said the Aztec having a much more hierarchical structure, does it seem that then there's a thesis that the more communal a society would be, as in many Native American Indian nations, that internal to their tribe or nation was a structure that didn't have the internal violence of the Aztecs then?
You can go back to Frederick Engels' book, Origin of the Family, State, and Private Property. That's basically what he was basically saying. And even though some of the details and stuff were not accurate and stuff, but basically if you look at the even if you go down to the Amazon, you'll see the people who are more the farmers who occupied the land, they became more aggressive than the people who were just hunting and gathering and moving from one region to another, who were not as aggressive.
I'd like to address this concept that you're talking about, the root of evil, or the root of violence. It seems to me that this whole idea of a master race, or the white supremacy, is just an excuse that's given to the masses that fight the wars, so to speak. But the reality is economic. Some would say I'm speaking from a Marxist position. I don't understand Marxism that much. But it would seem to me that the basis of all of this violence that we're talking about is basically economic. I support that with the idea that whenever there are these wars of aggression in Vietnam or the Crusades, from what I've been able to gather, there are numerous examples of people from both sides trading with each other, trading with the enemy, making a profit in working with the enemy, so that the whole concept of white supremacy or racism or the master race is put aside whenever the possibility, the economic possibility, looms into the foreground. I want to touch on something else here, too. I'm not really saying that money per se is the root of all evil. I don't think it's money itself. I don't think it's money in terms of exchange, a method of exchange, because a lot of the people who accumulate money and power, seems to me they've got a lot of it, and they're not using money as an exchange method. I mean, they've got money in their pocket, but they've already got all they need. They accumulate money in an abstract sense. People play the stock market, or people who, the rich people in this country who are the leaders and the movers and the shakers of our foreign policy. Money for them is kind of an abstract entity, which somehow coalesces with power. Hmm. And I'm not sure what it is about this accumulation of money and power that so attracts people. But I think therein lies the answer that we're seeking as to why this violence exists.
Well, could you broaden money? I mean, if you use money, could you also say a more broadened, that is resources, that is they're tangible resources to be gained in wars and in conflict, beyond I'm doing God's work. And of course, I was thinking when you said money, is it the exact quote in the Bible? It's not, money is the root of all evil, but I believe it says the love of money is the root of all evil. That is, it almost becomes this alienating force. And I recall when my friend and I did a book on Vietnam, there was a 1938 Naval Intelligence Report arguing that wars are always going to be justified for political, religious, ideological reasons, but ultimately, in the modern world, they were arguing it's really about economics and resources and markets. But, you know, they can't be as honest and blunt as General Smedley Butler was when he just said, you know, I was a racket man for First National City Bank when we went into Haiti. I mean, you know, nobody's going to get on TV and say that anymore. It has to be that we're going in for democracy or, you know, regardless of what side, we're going in to liberate people against capitalist oppression, you know, from the other side, or we're doing this because they're being oppressed, etc. So that beyond the ideology, beyond the belief that Evelyn, I'm sure, moved people during the Crusades, that, you know, they're going to go all this way and do all of this and nobody's going to get any resources. The other thing is, you know, remember Bertolt Brecht's wonderful poem, A Worker Reads History, you know, when Caesar conquered Gaul, were there cooks in his army? I mean, you know, the army has to be fed, it has to be clothed, it has to do this and that. Well, where's all this coming from? I mean, you know, you can pray, but if you don't have any weapons, you're in deep, you know what. So it's not a vulgar, I know, you're not making a vulgar Marxist analysis, but the idea that there are resources and conflicts, certainly in the modern world, helps explain some of this, at least to me.
But I think these are the excuses. I don't think we go to war for resources, and I don't think we go to war for money. I think the whole idea that you said from the Bible, the love of money, or the attraction of money, or what money represents.
Or power, you were talking about
power,
or the ability.
Well, that's...
Right, the ability to...
To manipulate the world in terms of power.
Well, but tangibly in the interests of some people over other people. I remember during the Vietnam War, we were in Vietnam for the freedom of the Vietnamese.
Well, that's why we're in Iraq, don't you know?
But I kept saying to myself, how come Kennedy and Johnson are not sending troops to Mississippi for the freedom of black people? And, you know, then I finally figured it out. I mean, they're not going to have Reconstruction again. So something else is going on.
I would like to suggest possibly this is going on. And that is, you know, in America, competition is like apple pie. We just idealize, think competition is the greatest thing. But competition causes separativeness. If you look at these tribes that they were talking about that, you know, were like wandering tribes and stuff, those kind of people shared with each other. And so there wasn't this competition. There wasn't this destructiveness. It's when they start to own land and then they're competing about who's going to get the land. So I would like to suggest that at the bottom of it all is this competitive nature of ours, and that that causes separativeness and the feeling that, you know, we're better than you or so forth. And that when we get around to the possibility of sharing the world's resources, that is, the rich nations have to share with the poor nations, and there has to be a redistribution of all the world's resources, you know, so that, like, all nations put into a giant computer what they have the most of and what they need, and then that whole thing is redistributed like that. So that if we need oil and we have wheat, we give the wheat away and we get some oil or whatever it is. However, whatever it is, I don't mean to say oil necessarily.
But how did we get to this point? I mean, I'm asking you a question because I've struggled with this. Mm-hmm. Let's say you're coming out of a history where people shared,
mm-hmm.
right? In a sense, they lived in a communal or communistic mm-hmm. existence.
Yes.
They're
mm-hmm.
sharing, all right? Now, let's say there's more surplus mm-hmm. at a certain point. Now, the thing I've never been able to figure out is how from primitive quotes, what we call primitive, but in communal societies that did not have the technological base we do, that were sharing, mm-hmm. once they had more surplus, why didn't they continue to be sharing communal societies? What is it about the surplus mm-hmm. that enables some to grab it over others? I don't know enough in terms of anthropology, mm-hmm. to suggest why didn't the same mm-hmm. philosophy exist? So rather than competing, wow, we have 10 hats now, and we're going to share them around more. We only had two before, and we got more crops, and nature or the gods have been good to us. It's an issue that I've never been able to, from my reading, to figure out why you end up with private property at a certain point. Fear and prejudice.
I think also it created a materialistic perspective, you know, concept in their minds of materialism. I think materialism is at the bottom, and at the top is sharing and so forth.
But what I'm saying is I'm ambivalent and struggling with this myself, because these were people that were not into materialist, what we think of materialist values. Mm-hmm. They were communal people. So, and in communal societies, people had things. People had spears, bows and arrows. Some had horses. They didn't have the horses belong to the group, though I might ride this particular horse. Why is it that the philosophy changed? I don't know. I'm asking this question. I don't have
basic economics. Poor people share because they all have nothing together. The minute that they
All right.
I'm going to back up because I think I can answer this right.
Oh, good.
We have a kind of a general intellectual idea of what sharing is. However, when there's enough, it's easy to share. And it would be anathema to think of someone not sharing. But what happens when the locusts come and wipe out your food supply? Suddenly, you don't have the surplus anymore. And nature itself has been the source of creating scarcity, though we might want to say that scarcity is not a reality. Water, droughts, things like that, suddenly there's not as much water to share. And then suddenly people start thinking, well, am I going to share with so-and-so? Maybe not. So I'll start hoarding it for myself. So the actual fact of scarcity caused by nature, I think, would create the other part of us which is less beneficent.
Would.
So that's just a quick
But that is not the history of what, certainly in terms of the Eastern Indian nations.
Oh,
they
I'm
went
just,
through periods of scarcity, yeah. And what they did is they... You know, you tighten your belt and you try to pull together in times of scarcity. And then, of course, when the crops were wonderful, then you're right, it's easier to share. So the question is, if you have a communal sense, you're connected with nature, let's say it's a tough time, then the idea is you share less, but everybody gets something at the table. So the question is how that shifts. I don't, you know,
yeah,
I'm struggling with the question because I don't know the answer.
There's some of the things, too. The concept of religion throws us into the notion of chosen ones, promised land, and God, the origin of violence, being a jealous God. So there leads into religion here, too. The concept that an army travels on its stomach could have led to the concepts of why our food is so standardized now, why we have so many chemicals in the food, because we want to make sure the GI around the world wakes up to the good old American breakfast, which will give him the security to go on and be the American that he has to be far from home. Something about women's thing, you were talking about the women's violence. I was curious to find out when and what other parts of the world practice genital mutilation, which is violence against women by patriarchy for sexual purposes. And that's an element that I hadn't learned about until just recently. That was of African origin, and I'm curious whether that comes from any other parts of the world. McKinley's assassin supposedly claimed divine inspiration that God told him to kill McKinley, so I'm not sure what the hell that means. And recently, Brooke Shields was on Oprah talking about her postpartum depression, and it suddenly made me react and recall my own depression. There was a point where, as a father, I felt that it was, and this was the logic of the depressed mind, I went to the edge on this, I went to suicide, and I felt that this man recently who killed his children by starting the fire in the hallway with the barbecue thing, then eventually overcame the children with the carbon monoxide, and he didn't succumb because somehow he managed, he was maybe too tall or whatever it is. His logic was, and my logic was too, life is so screwed, no one will ever take care of my children, the foster system is screwed, so it's better for me to kill them and to leave them abandoned in this culture. Now that flashed through my mind when I was at the height of depression. I didn't do it because I was intellectually prepared enough, because then I was aware of my feelings and I sought help. A lot of men don't understand their feelings well enough to come up claim. In fact, guys who talk about these neighbors, they say, oh, he was a nice guy, he had no problems at all. Here the guy was on the edge of depression and he kills his kid, so he was obviously a nice guy. But Brooke Shield, in her latest book on postpartum depression, talked about her tendency when she got very depressed not to do any violence to her children, but to put them in positions of risk, so that if something, she could fantasize that something could almost happen if she had like opened the door the wrong way or something. So she was flirting with this concept of letting the kids, you know, be neglected, So, and I give her credit for being bold enough to share that. So there are a couple things here that I think can touch on our understanding of...
But again, to go back to, and it's in terms of what I know, and there are many things I don't know, it's as much as I read, but when you read today in the U.S. of examples of horrific examples, as we saw a couple of weeks ago in Riverside County, where the investigator in the DA's office killed his wife, his mother, and his three kids, then killed himself. As far as I've been able to read in communal societies in the United States, I have never come across a single incident of any of that happening where in the Cayuga Nation or among the Cherokee or among the Lakota Sioux that someone who was an elder, a male, a chief, a warrior would do that to his wife and his children and then kill himself. I may have mentioned to you some years ago, because it was a spate of that in upstate New York, I wrote a piece called Men Shoot Yourselves First, so that if they want to take themselves, understandably, the other people are alive. What I'm saying is there's something in a culture, and it goes back to the question that Jay raised, human nature, if it's in our nature to go through depression and struggle, and I've been there, then how we deal with it is profoundly shaped by the culture in which we find ourselves. So that kind of violence against children is absolutely rare in certain societies. And in other societies, it's commonplace. It's incredibly commonplace here in the United States. Parents kill their kids all the time. I mean, it's an absolute epidemic here in the gentlest society on the planet. So if there's not a hardwired explanation for this, then we have to look at the interaction of culture and personality and patriarchy and violence and how that plays out in a society in which, of course, we commit ourselves to being nonviolent.
All right. I have, I guess, sort of two separate things to talk about. One is if we're going to talk about the nature of violence and is it inherent. There's a lot of things that are part of our animal survival, like storing fat is how we survived as people, but now it's become maladaptive because there's too much available for us to make ourselves too fat. So, I mean, we need to understand that mechanism. If we're innately violent, we need to understand it, but we have to realize at a certain point it's maladaptive. What do we do about it? And it's not a justification for violence just because it's part of our genetic makeup. And on another point, I think growing up, I heard the same stories that we hear about the American indigenous people. I heard about, as a Jewish person, we're the chosen people. Israel was all sand before the European Jews arrived there. The native Palestinians were barbaric. All Arabians are barbaric. So I think any propaganda that we listen to or any rhetoric, anything we need to challenge, how self-serving is it? Just challenge everything you believe. Is it self-serving? Is it not self-serving? Why do I believe this belief? I could even go so simple as, you know, women today that are so liberated, they say, well, men should pay for dates because my company is worth money. I mean, is that self-serving? Yes, it is. But I mean, it's very easy to follow any idea. And if it is self-serving, it's very easy to do that. So I think we just need to challenge everything that we hear, everything that we believe, right, left, middle, religious, whatever, and put it to that test. Do I believe this so strongly? Am I so emotional about it because it serves my needs or what I perceive as my needs? That's it.
And it's hard to step out of ourselves to filter what comes in, to ask in terms of what are the motives and is it true? Is it true what we've been told? And we know, we're adults here, that some of the things we've been told about societies, our societies, men, women, are simply not true. They're beliefs that have no basis in history and fact, but we take them in and they become part of our belief structure and we will cling to them no matter what truth is put in our face.
I wanted to just inject a piece of learning that I heard my teacher say. I have a teacher, Roger Weir, who I listen to every Saturday morning at the Bodhi Tree bookstore. His thesis is that starting with the time of Aristotle, the rational mind has become the most worshipped aspect of being human in Western culture, and that using the rational mind gives people the ability to control their environment, other people, in a whole variety of ways, and that this has been the downfall of Western culture, the overemphasis of the rational mind as opposed to the conscious mind or, you know, other aspects of humanity. And I've been listening to the discussion. I'm thinking, well, violence is a means of control, isn't it? As well as whatever else it might be. That's all I know how to say about this.
And talk about an ultimate means of control.
You mentioned the Calvinism and its relation to being a sort of a prototype in Ireland. And I was wondering if it's something that Christianity has specifically, or religion in general. Because when I look back at some of the historic events, the Christians may have killed more people than anyone. I mean, the people that settled the Americas were Christian, and they killed how many million Indians? And the Nazis were Christian. And I look back at all this, and I wonder if there's something peculiar about Christianity.
I don't know whether there's anything peculiar about Christianity, given that, I mean, for example, you can go to the Old Testament before Christianity, and I mean, it's been a while since I read the Old Testament, but it's certainly a bloody record of conquest and destruction. I think historically, while there have been the pacifist tradition in Christianity among Protestants or among Catholics, I mean, among Catholics, of course, the Catholic Worker and Dorothy Day, the Plowshares, there's certainly those traditions. But in terms of institutionalized in the West, and here we mean Europe West. We don't mean, because this is the West as opposed to the East, and when we talk about it's the West, they don't mean American Indian West. But it is clear when you look at the history of the dominant institution in the West, that is the Roman Catholic Church, you're talking about outright violence by the Vatican by itself and with armies and with kings and queens and so on, and the record is horrendous. Why that happened is certainly a matter of debate, but the extreme version would be, and if you go back and read, well, you can read Elie Wiesel on the Holocaust, you can read Daniel Jonah Goldenhagen, Hitler's Willing Executioners, you can read John Cornwell's book on Hitler's Pope, that a number of people arguing that essential, especially to the rise, you can't understand the rise of the Third Reich without understanding the Christian base that spent centuries demonizing Jews and preparing that. So we have to confront religion, and the dominant religion in the United States and in the West, in Europe, has been Christianity. It has not been Judaism, and it has not been Islam. And it's something, if we're going to look at institutions, and you can look at U.S. history, and Zinn doesn't get into it very much, but if you go back to the Puritans in New England, and you read the works of Cotton Mather and Bradford and the rest of them, I mean, they joyously celebrated the destruction of American Indians. I mean, those happen to be the facts, you know, we can't gloss them.
Did you say John Ware is your teacher?
Roger.
Oh, Roger Ware. It's really interesting because I was going to talk about the hunting and gathering societies and the strategies that they developed to maintain population to resource ratio. I would say that they were the really rational peoples, and that these Western societies developed irrationally in that they didn't maintain a rational ratio of population to resources, because the hunting and gathering societies developed really very strict strategies so that they would not allow population to increase beyond a certain amount so that they could maintain their lifestyle. And the strategies we considered barbaric, but I would consider them rational. They would abandon babies. Different societies had different strategies, but they were very strict and they maintained them. And to me, that is very rational. And here were the Westerners with their, quote, rational minds becoming violent because they couldn't maintain their population. They were irrational, and the violence maybe grew out of the irrationality, and we call them rational.
Eva, do you want to respond to...
I just want to mention that I think a good part of our problem is capitalism. I mean, this whole business of I'm better than you, you know. I'm going to own a business and you're going to work for me and you're going to do as you're told, you know what I mean, or you're out. It happens in small businesses and in big corporations. You have the person who owns the business sometimes might be a nice person,
But quite often, and I worked in a lot of different pharmacies, I'll tell you, and quite often the person who is the owner is very arrogant and has a whole superiority attitude. And of course, their superiority, part of that is based on the idea that they own this place and they're the big shot in this place and so on. You know, I mean, that whole being a big shot and being a boss and being better than other people, it all goes with the territory in capitalism. And of course, there's an economic base for that. They also have more money than other people. It's pretty sad.
So you're saying that explains the nature of violence? Or does that explain what's going on today?
The whole idea of superiority.
All right.
It may have something to do with violence, too.
Just to put this out there, it seems to me that the capitalism, the war, even the violence that we beget on each other are just symbols of what's happening inside. To me, the violence comes from us, each and every one of us, struggling with that something inside of us that wants to protect or hoard or whatever it is. Sometimes it's chemical. And the capitalism and that greed is it, and the wars are really just symbolized a struggle that we have inside of us as humans, as primates, and hopefully evolving to something that transcends that kind of selfish point of view.
I just wanted to respond to what you said earlier about the hunter-gatherers being more rational than Western civilization. That's basically what you said. It's a rational strategy. But I think it arose out of a deep, deep connection with nature, which when after Aristotle's time, Western civilization chose to worship the rational mind. In parallel with that, we've lost our connection with nature, and that leads to a kind of psychosis that has all kinds of bad effects.
Okay, these are a couple of observations about human nature relevant to this discussion of like where is the root of evil. One of them is from an exhibit about the Vikings that I saw, I think it was at the Natural History Museum a few years ago, and it's a quote that says, trading and raiding are not entirely separate activities. And the other one that I have is a quote from Henry Kissinger. It's his observation that power is the ultimate aphrodisiac.
And Henry should know. Yeah.
This is a comment and respond person on my right about internal coping mechanisms to our own sense of threat and fear. And the question is, who puts the sense of threat and fear into us? Where does that come from? And I would argue that Wilhelm Reich in the late 40s wrote a very well-known books on mass psychology, how to manipulate mass psychology. He was writing in the late 40s as a function of the middle 30s in Germany and how Hitler and the whole Nazi party with their massive parades and the Nuremberg and Heidelberg massive rallies with the searchlights and this entire emotional appeal that he made to the German people and how they reacted, responded back. And I would compare that now to what the Bush administration does through their manipulation and control, overwhelming control of the media now is differentiated than prior decades when no one had a grip on media the way they do now. And they are using the 9/11, they're using threats to inculcate fear into us so that we will then have those emotional reactions that you were commenting about. In other words, we're trying to cope with something that has been put upon us by an outside force by design. And we must challenge that outside force and have a rational ability in our own mind to say, I am feeling fearful from information I'm seeing, but someone is manipulating the information and making me feel fearful on purpose. And I rationally must reject that as the British people who have been faced with quote-unquote terrorism, not just from Northern Ireland in London, but the so-called Arab terrorists within London, but in the recent elections, of all the issues upon which to decide to vote for the government, I think number 14 was terrorism and the fear of terrorism. It was way down the bottom of the list. They simply had virtually no concern over terrorism in Britain. Why did in the United States it be number one in the recent elections? Because the ability of the power structure to manipulate the information and make us feel fearful when we otherwise did not need to be and do not need to be.
I wanted to go back to what Zinn said in this chapter that you could discuss more, and that is that the allies of the Native Americans were the lower classes who were also hunters and were on the frontier, that they had natural alliances being in nature and being at the lower end of the class. Could you talk about that more? Because that, you know, that where your violence goes, who's the victim and who's the victimizer, also relates to class. It's sort of his notion ties almost everything we're talking about together.
Well, some, as far as I understand, some of the, I guess we would call them frontiersmen, hunters, traders, trappers, etc., in what is now the continental United States and in places like Quebec, parts of Canada, some of those, almost all males, had developed humane relationships with indigenous peoples, and on many occasions there was intermarriage. They were the exceptions, though, in terms of the movement of the expansion for those of European background as the country grew, the colonies, and then into the Midwest, the Northwest Territory, into the Plain States, the extension of the railroad, and of course the destruction for the Plains Indians of Buffalo. So there, again, if you go back to this notion of, you know, where does this violence come from? Some people met who came from dramatically different cultural backgrounds and did not engage in violence with each other and were close with each other. Others did not. And so that's where I'm always have a problem with being hardwired, because then how do we explain, you know, I mean, hardwiring is hardwiring. I mean, there's certain, you just can't undo certain parts of our hardwiring. So some people, I think even some of the ones we read about, you know, Davy Crockett or Bowie or some of those folks, you know, they were out there and they actually had pretty decent relationships. I'm not sure which Indian nations they did.
Davy Crockett was a member of Congress. He was a frontiersman. He had fought in the Creek War. He had always lived with Indians where he lived, and he didn't like what they did to the Creek, burning villages, killing children, women. Andrew Jackson got him to run for Congress because he had this heroic image, which he did do. He became a congressman. But when Jackson moved in on the Indians, Crockett was one of the few congressmen that stood up to him.
Wow.
And that's when he lost the next term, which then led him to go to move to Texas. He wanted to become a politician there, and he thought the war was over, but he got caught up in the war there. But he was very sympathetic to the Native people's struggles.
Wow.
Bowie was not. Bowie was a butcher, slave yeah. runner. Smuggler.
Well, I don't remember seeing that in that Fess Parker show.
Davy Crockett.
Okay. Your reference to Aristotle was interesting because Michael Parenti several years ago did a book on one of his history things where he talked about Aristotle's justification of slavery in his politics. And Parenti's point was that there must have been an active resistance against slavery for Aristotle to have had to write a justification of slavery to rationalize or justify the rational society. In terms of getting away from nature, it was interesting, the latest tsunami in the Asian continent, the animals were able to avoid and run. However, the Europeans who wanted to be vacationing in the middle of winter somewhere where it would be really nice just somehow couldn't have. And of course, I think somehow we got involved because there were Americans over there. There were a hell of a lot of European Swedes and Northern Europeans who got killed, and thousands, I think, were as how many Americans were there? Some model's boyfriend got killed, and now she's all over television. I mean, we really get caught up in the concerns when Americans get. But again, there's just a couple of points there.
Well, quick announcements before we break for this evening. All right. And thank you. Drive carefully. Well, see everyone next month.
You have been listening to Dr. John Marciano's discussion group from May 24th, 2005, when they considered Chapter 7 of Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Every month, a group led by Dr. Marciano meets to discuss individual chapters. They meet at the Venice United Methodist Church Peace Center. To join the group, contact Dr. Marciano at 310-393-4815 or John Marciano at macmac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of the decentralized democratic civic media.